Coffee House Shots is sponsored by EDF, Britain's biggest generator of zero carbon electricity. Find out how we are busy helping Britain achieve net zero at www.edfenergy.com.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by Katie Bors and James Forsyth. So today the Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab was in front of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee answering questions about his handling of the Afghanistan situation. Here's what he had to say.
We wanted to get some of those embassy guards
through,
but the buses arranged to collect them, to take them to the airport, weren't given permission to enter. And that is, I'm afraid, a reflection of the conditions on the ground. We will, of course, which comes back to the third country arrangements.
They were held up due to paperwork. So let's stick with some of this, because the Defence Secretary, sorry, let's stick with the same issue, because
true.
You can't say whether they're here or not, it sounds like. So you're not answering the question, so allow me to move on.
Neil,
the Defence Secretary, who I think is credited by most as having worked his socks
off
through this crisis, you're not answering the question, Foreign Secretary, so let's move on.
Katie, how did you think that Dominic Raab did? Because he does seem a little bit irritated at times at being asked so many hard questions, and it did run on for quite a long time.
I think ahead of his appearance, it was dubbed almost by some as a make or break appearance, which I was always a bit sceptical of, just in the sense that we know that Boris Johnson doesn't really play by conventional wisdom when it comes to ministers being sacked or pushed out. He tends to stick with his ministers. But I also think that it wasn't the horror show, just objectively, that it could have been for Dominic Raab. It doesn't mean to say it went particularly well, but I don't think he emerged weaker than he was going in. And you could see the line of defence that Dominic Raab is going for, which we talked about yesterday, which is ultimately saying this is down to military intelligence failures. That's why people were caught off guard. It doesn't link it so specifically with his holiday, but clearly the implication is they couldn't have made plans so time-specific because everything was suggesting this would take a longer time, and actually it was unlikely that Kabul would fall this year. Now, I think what was interesting was Tom Tugendhat, the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, started quoting a Foreign Office risk document from July suggesting actually things were going to move rapidly. And I think more generally, when Dominic Raab was on that holiday, I don't think he had to work in the Foreign Office, could look at what was happening in Afghanistan and see things were deteriorating. But I think you can see what the Foreign Office line of defence is. And I think you could also see Dominic Raab very defensive when it came to, A, the holiday. I think he was asked 10 times when he went on holiday and refused to say. But also in terms of his work, he suggested he had never thought about resigning, suggesting he was working constantly. And I think also used the fact that he's travelling to the region very soon to say that, as a modern foreign secretary, I can work from anywhere. I think it's almost Boris Johnson is adopting it. It's a modern prime minister who is on the West Coast, but not on holiday, but working with his family in a house. So it's a new way of remote working by the government. But I think on the specifics, do we learn that much new? I think that Dominic Raab didn't skip around the fact that ultimately, the Foreign Office do not know how many eligible Afghans are stuck in Afghanistan for the Foreign Office scheme, particularly because that scheme is so broad. I think it's much harder than the Ministry of Defence scheme, which is very specifically, have you worked in these certain times with the UK, which does mean it's really hard to pinpoint. And then I think going forward, it was interesting that the way Dominic Raab was talking about foreign policy, because actually, despite all the criticism recently of Joe Biden, much of it anonymous on the UK side, you could see where there were quite a lot of common points of view there.
James, what were some of the standout moments for you from the hearing?
Well, I think as Katie says, you know, he talked about the intelligence, the idea that Kabul would not fall this year, but it would be a steady and slow deterioration. I was very struck by that because in the forthcoming issue of The Spectator magazine, Katie's interviewed Defence Secretary Ben Wallace, who basically says it wasn't a failure of intelligence. Mm. He argues that, you know, these collapses when of states when they happen very quickly. That is one of the natures of it, and that is one of the limits of what the intelligence can do. I think Katie's right that there were no disasters with Dominic Raab, but I also think he didn't actually answer any of the questions about, you know, when he went on holiday, what he is. And I thought there was also a question here about working method. One of the criticisms of him is he hasn't spoken to the British ambassadors in the region. He says, look, I don't need to pick up the phone to get a sense of what's on the ground, talking about the diptels he gets. I think sometimes, though, you do get more, and this is different people have different ways of working, but I do think you get more out of speaking to people directly than you do about reading their written reports. They're a different thing. And then I think there is a question right here, again, that to come back to Casey's interview with Ben Wallace, where he's sort of kind of implicit criticism, which is, he talks about in that interview how getting out is the most difficult thing. And I think what is quite clear is that the UK was not prepared for getting people out, not just in terms of the Afghan schemes and the like, but also in terms of relations with neighbouring countries, discussions. You know, there was a very pointed moment when Dominic Raab said he had been to Pakistan, and Tom Tugendhat, the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, and it's quite clear that there is no love lost between those two, said, you know, as Foreign Secretary, he said, I had to say no. I think you see the criticisms that you can make of the government's handling of this, but I think, as Katie said, I don't think today made the situation any worse for Dominic Raab. And I think when you're a minister, it was a reminder, you know, it wasn't a dispatch about the House of Commons, but, you know, often the safest place for a minister in a crisis is actually answering questions from MPs, because it allows you to put your side of the story across and gives you some protection. I thought on the holiday point, he obviously doesn't want to say, but I just don't see how it is tenable to not say when you were off, that's going to have to come out at some point. I think to pick up on Katie's point, I was very struck by the bit when you talked about the inhospitable conditions for nation building, whether the mission was simply too broad, whether it didn't match capabilities. And I did think this was interesting because there's been a lot of UK government kind of in private kind of shock at Joe Biden's speech last night. I actually thought this was an appreciation that there is actually something to this, that whether the West does have the capabilities to do these things. And then I think the other interesting question here, which is how explicit the Biden speech last night was, that he wanted to get the US out of Afghanistan to concentrate on great power competition with China and Russia. I think the people who are saying that the speech is about a retreat from the world are wrong, in that I think what this is saying is about a different set of US priorities in the world. I think, you know, Joe Biden is, and those around him are very taken with the Nixon and Kissinger pull out of Vietnam. Everyone says, well, you know, you can't do that. But that then enables the US to concentrate more directly on its competition with the Soviet Union. And, you know, 14 years after the fall of Saigon, the Berlin Wall comes down.
But James, just briefly on that, I mean, hasn't the situation in Afghanistan actually left China in a more strong position, because it is now seen as a peacemaker in the region, and the West is even talking about working with China to keep stability there?
I think the withdrawal from Afghanistan has been badly handled. I think it is dishonourable, considering the risks that Afghans took in terms of, taking an example close to all of our hearts, you know, setting up newspapers, media, educating girls, setting up schools, those kind of things. I mean, that is clearly dishonourable. I think in terms of great power competition with China, I think this causes problems for China. One of the reasons why the Taliban advance was so fast was they had Uyghur militants who had fought in the Syrian civil war fighting on their side. They think, you know, that is clearly going to be a source of tension between China and a Taliban run Afghanistan. I think the slight view of some of those who've been involved in Afghan policy since 9/11 about whether China and Russia want to get involved is, you know,
have it
slightly, you know,
be my guest.
And I think there is that tension. I think this does cause, I think the bigger question is whether it undercuts other countries' belief in the US's reliability as an ally. I think that is the big danger. But then someone sympathetic to what the administration has done in terms of pulling out of Kabul was making the case to me this morning that, you know, look at the stock market in Seoul, look at the stock market in Taipei. They are at record highs. You know, if those two US allies thought that this was a sign that the US was not going to protect them from China, you would not expect their stock markets to be in such a bullish mood.
I'm just going to give a quick self-plug for Chinese Whispers, where we talk about China and Afghanistan, whether or not it's a blessing or a curse. So Coffee House Shots listeners should check out that episode. James is just spitting his coffee out at this shameless plug. Katie,
I thought you'd invite James Marriott on to discuss his recommendations of it.
Yes, it's a highly rated 4-star podcast. Katie, where does all this leave Tom Tugendhat's reputation in the party? I'm quite curious about him. He's been seen as a rising star throughout the last few years, but he's never managed a cabinet role because he's not quite in Boris Johnson's camp. But has his dealing of the Afghanistan situation set him greater stead in the hearts and minds of backbenchers?
I think his speech when you had the recall of parliament was something that drew praise across the house. Tory MPs, Labour MPs, Lib Dem MPs, SNP MPs. It was beyond party politics. And I think from there, you obviously then get the talk up because everything has to be magnified of, is he a future leader? But then I think there was a little bit of a mistake, or at least the way things turned out, it backfired slightly because I think there was quite a lot of press about Tom Tugendhat after that. So there was an interview in the Mail. Now, I think Tom Tugendhat said that he didn't have anything to do with the headline, but it was suggesting, you know, of course I'm attracted to a leadership role. And that's the kind of thing that then turns off some Tory backbenchers, because they are behind the cause and they're behind the stance. But if they think it's then being used to further someone's own career, it falls away a bit. So I think he is very well respected. I just think as in there was definitely some whispers about that. And I think today in the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, I don't think anyone's in any doubt that Tom Tugendhat is in a very good position to be asking these questions and has a wealth of experience that the Commons is lucky to have. I think what's interesting is that you mentioned the fact that he has not made cabinet, he's not a minister, and it doesn't feel as though Tom Tugendhat is on a path where he is particularly trying to be. I think Boris Johnson and Tom Tugendhat have a bit of a rivalry going back a while, but also it goes almost back to this party management issue, which is there are some talented MPs who ultimately have decided for various reasons it's not worth their time trying to climb the ladder or, you know, play the game in terms of promotion, whether that's because they don't want it or the fact is they don't think they'd be welcome to it. And I think that is something which more widely, if you think about the number that is, should trouble number 10.
And James, we've been talking about booster shots on this podcast for a while, but now there seems to have been something of a decision made about what we can expect later in the year. Can you talk about it?
Just tonight, the JCVI are saying that people with an immunosuppressed immune system, it will be recommended that they get a third dose of the vaccine, and because, you know, signs that the two doses might not have the effect on them that those people with a more functioning immune system would have had. I think this is interesting in that it's a relatively limited booster program at the moment. Obviously, it doesn't preclude other announcements. And I think there is a tension here. I think that, you know, if you think back to the beginning, you know, the UK was the first country to administer a COVID vaccine outside of a clinical trial. And that wasn't actually the UK developed AstraZeneca vaccine, that was a Pfizer vaccine. And at the time, lots of ministers, you know, said, look, this is an example of, you know, the JCVI and our good regulators, and, you know, this is an advert for, you know, why you should do business in Britain kind of post-Brexit. I mean, there are now some tensions just barely beneath the surface between the government and the JCVI, because the JCVI regards, on the booster program, you know, the question about individual benefit. I mean, ministers would much rather they thought about kind of collective. And I mean, ministers who are obviously not vaccinologists or experts on this kind of thing, but I mean, ministers' kind of view is, well, if there was a risk that the vaccine effectiveness wanes, what's the harm in giving people another dose? So I think there's that tension there. And then I think on school kids, there's a tension, you know, as I say in the magazine coming out tomorrow, we can all plug our things.
Katie hasn't had to plug her own thing.
Trying to think of something to plug.
No, we plugged the Ben Wallace interview for you.
I know, but, you know, I feel like I need to do my bit.
That they thought they would have made further progress down the age cohorts by now. And, you know, I think the ministers are casting some envious glance at those countries which have, for some time now, actually been offering vaccines to everyone over 12. And I think that is creates a kind of a heightened nervousness in Whitehall about the return to school next week. And so I think although those tensions are playing out, but I don't think this is unique here. You know, we see a clash between Biden and appointing new FDA leadership because, again, he wants to do booster shots and the FDA are uncertain about it. So I think that this, and then there's another aspect of tension, I think, coming down the line, which is, you know, we've heard from lots of the Oxford team, well, look, actually, it would be better to be sending these shots to the developing world to have a kind of more, because, you know, more countries immunise, you reduce the risk of variants emerging rather than concentrating on rich countries offering yet another dose of the vaccine to their own citizens. So I think you can see these tensions, and I think they are going to grow. And I think you saw Nicola Sturgeon today in Scotland saying, you know, talking not only about the kind of vaccine certification plan, that the events that she is planning to introduce those for, but also warning that, you know, the rise in cases in schools around Scotland has been so sharp. She's saying, look, if it carries on like this, she might be in a position of having to reintroduce some kind of restrictions at some point. And so I think that when schools return in England, I think we are in for a nervous few weeks to see whether you do get a spike in cases, what effect that has on our situation, and how long that is sustained. I think one other interesting thing worth noting is how much the change in the rules on self-isolation changed the economic effects of a rise in COVID cases. There's an interesting story in the FT today about how consumer credit was basically zero in July because essentially as people hunkered down at home because of the rise in virus cases. Now, was that because people were wary about getting the virus, or was that because people were wary about getting pinged? I think that would be interesting. I suspect that later this month we will get some data which will allow us to work out which of those it was.
And I just would say on the jabs, I mean, I think James is completely right. There's so much nervousness about the return of schools if you look at what it has coincided with in terms of the rates in Scotland when pupils returned. More generally, yes, the UK is behind several European countries on child vaccination, but also the general vaccination programme. You now have a situation where I think France has overtaken the UK in terms of vaccination. So that early stage where I think perhaps some of the government feeling pretty happy with themselves has now passed, and we're no longer, you know, an outlier or ahead in terms of the success of our vaccine program. So there was lots of good work done, but we're not particularly standing out now, and therefore it doesn't mean, I think, that before there was a sense that the UK had an advantage over others, and I think that has gone now.
Especially over France. We definitely want to beat France. Katie and James, thanks very much. And thank you for listening to this episode of Coffee House Shots. Do join us again tomorrow. And remember to pick up an issue of the magazine to read Katie's interview with Ben Wallace and James's political column.